Okay. As I was saying, that in terms of getting specific questions answered, I have to tell this war story. It was a lady that I represented on pulmonary hypertension who met the listing, but we didn't have the language chlorpulmonol anywhere in her medical records. And I kept trying to get the doctor to write me a letter that says she has chlorpulmonol. And she went through all these convoluted, we tried to, she ended up losing her insurance, moving in with her adult son because she couldn't keep the mortgage up anymore. The day of the hearing, like 3 days before, I got the letter from the doctor, said chlorpulmonol. The judge looked at the letter and says, oh, it says chlorpulmonol, we don't need a hearing now. Because that was the only thing that was missing as far as the judge was concerned, that we didn't have that specific language in the medical records previously. So, you know, we're kind of at the mercy of medical providers in terms of getting records, in terms of their financial requirements, their legal disclosure requirements, because HIPAA's made it much more difficult. For every medical provider out there, there's, you know, an independent interpretation of what a medical release has to have in it. And we spend a lot of time sending medical releases back and forth saying, well, will you accept this? Will you accept this? Why don't you send me one of yours and I'll have them sign your release and then send it back to you? And all this stuff takes time.
Landry, you made a passing reference to the idea of expanding the listings. Could you give us a little bit more detail, follow up on that a little bit?
Well, to the extent that some of these rare diseases and conditions that probably clearly meet the listing, would meet listings level severity, aren't in the listings, it would certainly speed up matters if they were. That's really what I meant. I mean, If you can actually get the medical criteria for a listed impairment, and often you can. I mean, we don't see too many listings cases that come out of cases that should have been listing allowances that come out of RDDS. So I got to think RDDS catches a lot of them. They're able to get the specific medical criteria that you all agree meet your definition. And so to that extent, it would be helpful to have more listings for these conditions.
One specific suggestion I have on that, this was something that came up before at a policy conference for the immune deficiency listings. With primary immune deficiency or cell-mediated immune deficiency, there's roughly 100 different disorders that fall under that umbrella. There's not a list anywhere in the explanatory material that says which conditions are considered primary immune deficiencies. And even just a list saying, you know, if it's one of these conditions, hypogammaglobulinemia, you need to look at primary immune deficiency as the listing that applies in that situation. So even just a laundry list that says, you know, this may be the appropriate listing to look at for this particular condition would go a long way towards streamlining the 7,000 number that we're looking at, because many of these conditions overlap.
I've got a couple of questions, and I'll make some statements before I ask you for some answers or just responses. Are there groups of diseases, rare diseases, that particular not represented within the ICD-9? That would be one of the first questions. And then how frequently do you really run into this situation where they're not included? And just to give you some of the background information, I mean, I think all of us know how difficult it is for many of the rare disorders it is to really obtain the diagnosis because of the expression of the disease, and that affects multiple organs, and you always don't get those clear-cut diagnostic criteria, boom, or even imaging results right away to say this is this rare disease. So it is a particular problem. But I do want just to mention, too, that the World Health Organization has established an advisory group on rare diseases that we are looking at revisions in the ICD. Now, this, I think, will not be completed until around 2015 for the ICD-11. And I'm going to think, I know I'm well beyond the Social Security eligibility at that time, but hopefully we can keep working on it till then. But I think there are a number of us that want to do something that we can address this issue immediately, that perhaps we can get some information out more readily. So if you have any thoughts at all about, you know, are there particular groups of disease that we should look at first off, that would be helpful. And then to what extent is it a problem?
It is a problem that there are, as you said, a lot of conditions that don't have specific ICD-9 diagnostic codes, or a lot of times more than one code can apply depending on how the medical evidence is interpreted. And so it's hard for me to come up with a specific one and say this is one that's not included. I would say in general that anything that moves us toward helping adjudicators to identify rare chronic conditions and what part of the regulations might be applied to them is going to be beneficial. We're not going to be able to do it perfectly either now or in 2015, but we can at least do a little bit better now than we're doing currently in terms of saying, you know, there is a specific ICD-9 code for this particular condition, and these are the specific functional limitations that experts tell us are often associated with that condition. Like I said, I think that there are, you know, a lot of conditions that I'd like to see listed. But the other, you know, the other side of that again comes back to the same thing I was saying about adjudicators is often true of specialists. Sometimes they don't see more than a couple of patients with these conditions as well. And so they may not be familiar that there is even an ICD-9 for that particular condition, or, you know, they may not see it enough to know much more about it than what's in, you know, the medical literature about it. So they don't often have a lot of the treating experience that would allow them to address it in the fashion that we're talking about either. That's one of the problems we run into with rare conditions is that there's not enough people with these conditions where we can really come up with a consistent approach saying this is going to work in all situations for all people with rare chronic conditions because A, they're very variable, and B, it's so unpredictable as to which person is going to have it.
I think as you go through those, it's very important, again, to include the community of advocates when you look at it to say, okay, this is what we're seeing from a medical standpoint, and make sure that we're including the people who will take the listing and then try to turn it into benefits, as well as the voluntary health groups that understand the people and, again, the denial that goes along with it and what you're not going to see in the medical records and need to ask for both of the person and of the physicians.
Number of questions and comments about functional capacity and about collecting evidence. There was one comment, I believe, that suggested something like we need to be looking at functional capacity in the pre-hearing stages. Ms. Lange, I think you may have said something like that, or if I misunderstood that, I apologize.
I did. What I meant, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear, was that, you know, more functional capacity, better functional capacity needs to be collected earlier on in the process at the initial and reconsideration levels, along the lines of what Bill testified to, ask more specific questions, really go after it in a much more targeted way.
Is there a better way to do it than the way we've been doing it? I mean, we ask for functional capacity information, obviously apparently more at the hearing stage than we do perhaps at the pre-hearing stage, but is there a different way to do it?
Well, I think at the initial stages, you're always starting with a form, and so the forms could be better. The forms could ask more information. I think one of the areas that is almost never collected is the effect of fatigue or the effect of treatment on people. I think Bill mentioned this as well. You know, a lot of folks are able to do something. Remember, one judge, federal court judge, said you don't have to vegetate in a dark room to meet the Social Security disability standard. So, you know, people are able to do some things, and the trick is to figure out when they can't do enough to meet the standard. So often people are, you know, doing household chores. This comes up a lot, but how do you do them? And the sense that there's no sense that it's different to be able to do household chores in your own home on your own time and take a break when you need to, than to be able to be on the job, with your supervisor breathing down your neck, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week on a consistent basis without too many absences. So that kind of information isn't collected. It typically isn't collected until, my experience, you get to a hearing, especially if you have an advocate who sort of looks at that and understands your condition. I think a lot of rare chronic conditions include this sort of feature of fatigue and the need to rest and sort of very debilitating treatments.
I mean, let me cut in for a second. I mean, we have been trying to look at that in a very hard way, and to the extent that we can find ways to make it objective and easy, we're trying to do that. I mean, one of the nice things that the staff put into the recent digestive regs is that we
collapse most severe forms of liver disease and said if you have a common diagnostic score for liver is called the MELD score. It's a composite of three different elements. And if your MELD score is 22 or higher, we're not going to bother going through the individual analysis and with all the indeterminacy of that, and we're just going to say, on the basis of the medical evidence, we can conclude conclusively that you can't stand and do the various things that you're required to do for a functional analysis. We're not going to be able to get away from collecting that information in the vast majority of the cases, and there's always going to be issues with that. That's, a lot of that is probably an unsolvable issue. But we are looking on a disease category by disease category basis to see if there are other generalizations that we might be able to make, particularly, this gets outside of rare diseases, but particularly for some of the very large diseases where we see recurring cases. So one of the things, you know, we've been talking to NIH about a couple of issues, but one of the ones that I'm very interested in is looking at imaging techniques that measure blood flow to the heart, because I do think for a wide range of cardiac diseases, it may be possible to use new technology to draw some lines that would make some of that anecdotal evidence irrelevant in particular cases. Again, we can't do that for everyone, but we may be able to do that in a fairly substantial number of cases and greatly improve the process. So this is a fairly new thing for us, but it's something we're very open to, and if you've got suggestions as to where we might be able to draw those lines for other categories of cases, encourage you to let us know. And we're also getting away from only doing the comprehensive review. So if we've got two or three things that we need to clarify in a listings reg, you know, we're not going to wait for, you know, the cycle of our recent history, which can be a very long one, to update them. We're willing now. We haven't done it yet, but we're in the process of getting started to do that, to do some relatively small adjustments in the regs where it makes sense for us to do it. So if you've got recurring categories of cases where you think we might be able to cut through some of these things, we're very open to taking a look at that.
That's great, and I think it's very helpful to do it that way. I think it would also be helpful to note where these kinds of limits can occur with particular range of diagnoses, even if you can't come up with the objective test, is to just let it be known that it is a consideration, and you know, they can do the usual evidence gathering and credibility findings that you have to do when it's not an objective test.
Responding back to the judge's initial question about the how can we improve the ROC evaluation, the biggest issue that I see with the forms that are sent out is that it asks, you know, how long can you walk, how long can you stand, how long can you sit, lift, carry, various activities. It never asks, can you do this all the time, or are there times when you can't do this? And I think that's the biggest issue, is that many of our patients with rare chronic conditions focus on when they can do something. Yes, when I'm feeling good, I can walk a block. Let's not talk about those 2 or 3 days out of the month when I stay in bed all day because I can't do that. So I think it really needs to be focusing more on the good days, bad days type of thing, because I will tell you that once it gets to the hearing level, that's typically where the judges want to go, is talking about how often can you do these things and what are the limitations there. If we got that information into the system earlier, I think it would improve the adjudication process at the lower levels.
It's also a matter of quality, quantity, and duration, because if you one of the first cases that really made an impression on me, if the spouse hadn't been there, the gentleman said that he could cook for himself, he could shower by himself, he could go grocery shopping, he could go ice fishing. And he made peanut butter and jelly, he couldn't do anything. But nobody asked him until we got to the hearing, what do you cook, how long do you stand, when you shower, how long does it take you to recover, and after ice fishing, how many days are you down? And that's the main thing I find. It's gardening or it's yard work. And how many days does it take afterwards? But I'm sure you ask those questions at hearings. I have always seen that. I've never seen an unrepresented hearing. But I'm sure that those are the questions that are asked when there isn't an advocate, and those are the questions that need to be asked when there isn't an advocate at the lower levels.
Yeah, I've sat in on some hearings recently, and at least the ones I've seen, they tend to do a pretty good job on that. And it is, at the end of the day, it's an art rather than a science. There's judgment that we ask the judges to use, and we can't break it down so it's automatic, because at some point, most of these cases are very different, and you've got to just rely on your experience and your intuition to get the right kind of information out. And it is sometimes very surprising, you know, when you sit through one of these and you think you know which way it's going to go, and then all of a sudden something comes up and you see it, you know, in a very different light, and that's not atypical.
I think we feel pretty comfortable by the time we get to a hearing, because again, nobody fakes our conditions. It's all a matter of determining the severity. We're usually pretty comfortable, but the problem is until we get to the hearing, and those 2 years, people suffer so much that if we could get the questions that we would ask at the hearing, whether it's an advocate or whether it's you as the finder of fact, at that point we would have the delay, because the RFC determination would be made by asking the questions in a way that you'll get qualitative information rather than yes, no. And I think we also have people, you know, I'm dyslexic. I hate writing on forms. I don't know that I would do such a great job of representing myself if I were disabled. And I think that's the information that we're relying on. We need lower level adjudicators to ask the questions that you or I would ask to make sure that we get the real answers on RFC.
We're almost up on time. Let me just do one last check. Dave, any more? Okay, I think we're up all set, and remarkably, we're going to break 2 minutes early. We've given you a long break, not only because we're aware that people have BlackBerries and need work to catch up on, but we are in sort of a restaurant wasteland here, and I do apologize for that. Not much I can do about that. So we've given a little bit longer than we probably would ideally do. So we have a break for an hour and a half. We have two more panels in the afternoon. Oh, yes, there's a list of restaurants in the packet. Best of luck with that. I'm not vouching for any of them. And we've got two more really interesting panels in the afternoon. So again, I want to thank our witnesses for a very helpful presentation, and I look forward to two equally good presentations this afternoon. Thank you.
Questions that are asked when there isn't an advocate, and those are the questions that need to be asked when there isn't an advocate at the lower levels.
Yeah, I've sat in on some hearings recently, and at least the ones I've seen, they tend to do a pretty good job on that. And it is, at the end of the day, it's an art rather than a science. There's judgment that we ask the judges to use, and we can't break it down so it's automatic, because at some point, most of these cases are very different, and you've got to just rely on your experience and your intuition to get the right kind of information out. And it is sometimes very surprising, you know, when you sit through one of these and you think you know which way it's going to go, and then all of a sudden something comes up and you see it, you know, in a very different light, and that's not atypical.
I think we feel pretty comfortable by the time we get to a hearing, because again, nobody fakes our conditions. It's all a matter of determining the severity. We're usually pretty comfortable, but the problem is until we get to the hearing, in those 2 years, people suffer so much that if we could get the questions that we would ask at the hearing, whether it's an advocate or whether it's you as the finder of fact, at that point we would have the delay, because the RFC determination would be made by asking the questions in a way that you'll get qualitative information rather than yes, no. And I think we also have people, you know, I'm dyslexic. I hate writing on forms. I don't know that I would do such a great job of representing myself if I were disabled, and I think that that's the information that we're relying on. We need lower level adjudicators to ask the questions that you or I would ask to make sure that we get the real answers on RFC.
We're almost up on time. Let me just do one last check. Dave, any more? Okay, I think we're up all set, and remarkably, we're going to break 2 minutes early. We've given you a long break, not only because we're aware that people have BlackBerries and need work to catch up on, but we are in sort of a restaurant wasteland here, and I do apologize for that. Not much I can do about that. So we've given a little bit longer than we probably would ideally do. So we have a break for an hour and a half. We have two more panels in the afternoon. Oh, yes, there's a list of restaurants in the packet. Best of luck with that. I'm not vouching for any of them. And we've got two more really interesting panels in the afternoon. So, again, I want to thank our witnesses for a very helpful presentation, and I look forward to two equally good presentations this afternoon. Thank you.